All right. As much as we wanted to listen to the cool intro, I guess we better get down to business, right?
I guess.
Yeah.
If we have to.
Yeah. We just leave that. We might get more viewers or listeners, whatever you want to call them. I guess it could be viewers or listeners, depending on where you're tuning in from, right? I guess.
It could be. You could be listening on whatever platform. I'm not sure where you're posting it, but.
I guess, I guess when we're live, it would be audio video, right? Because it goes to LinkedIn and it goes to YouTube. I guess you could look away from our hideous faces and just listen to our nice voices, you know, or our radio voices.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. All right, man. Let's just jump right in. What do I want to start with? There were a couple interesting AWS news releases. There is the AWS MCP server, which, if I recall, we talked about, like, it feels like ages ago now, but it is now generally available. And the thing that I wrote down as I was reading through, I read the blog post and I read the news release. And the thing that caught my eye is that they termed it, or they used the phrase succeeds. So they say succeeds the MCP servers that are available in AWS labs. That struck a little fear in my heart because I'm like, does that mean those things are going away? Because my whole workflow is built on those. so that was maybe a little concerning. But I don't know. I guess that's going to happen, right?
Yeah. Sounds like you might have a new personal project.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
a little more mission critical, but
just what I need, right? And I don't know. I know people like to joke about AWS being confusing with product names and stuff like that. Like Amazon Quick Desktop is a great example. We talked about it last week. I don't know how many times in the last week I've seen a news release and I'm like, well, is this just Amazon Quick? Or is this Amazon Quick Desktop? Because it doesn't say, right? Mm. So anyways, it's the point I'm trying to make, I think, badly, is that this is another example, I think, of confusing stuff, right? So there's this announcement about the AWS MCP server, which then they mention is part of the AWS agent tool, or sorry, the agent toolkit for AWS, which contains MCP servers, skills, and plugins. So I guess if you want to use it, I don't know if it's a standalone MCP server and or you need the agent toolkit on top. I don't know. So
I mean, best guess, it's standalone, but also you can, like, it seems like it's used for making API calls or documentation searches. So they kind of bundle them both in.
Well, to me, again, like, back to the AWS Labs thing, what they've done is they're basically consolidating a bunch of MCPs that they've had for a while, because they've had an AWS documentation MCP for a long time. I use it every single day because I chuckled when I was reading the news article. They're like, hey, agents are great, but a lot of times agents can't keep up to AWS because, you know, they might not be trained on current data sets and therefore it won't work. I'm like, yeah, but you've had this MCP for a long time, which references the current documentation. So it's true, but not really, right? So, you know, it's just, it looks like it's a bunch of consolidating of MCPs that they've got. The other thing that I noticed there, and I don't know exactly what this means, is, do you remember we talked about, again, it was probably a couple months ago, agent SOPs? Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Too? Well, they also write in there that this is meant to transition from agent SOPs to skills. So maybe SOPs have come and gone already. I don't know.
Seems like, I mean, the space is moving so fast. We went from skills to your Claude MD to, I mean, just there's so many different things coming out.
Yeah. The other thing that made me chuckle was the actual demo in the blog post was kind of kind of silly.
Oh yeah.
They're like without the AWS MCP server, if you try to query for something new like S3 vector tables, it won't know. But look, if you put in this MCP, it knows what it is. Ta-da. And I'm like, you could do that without using this MCP server, but anyways,
you could just search the web, I guess.
You could just search the web like in the olden days, right? Imagine opening a search tool in your browser and actually looking for something. The horrors,
in the
right?
long ago.
Yeah, right. All joking aside, I can't remember the last time I actually did a Google search, but that's for another episode. And then the note that I made here was just like, I think this is cool. As much as I'm kind of I'm just being a little cranky because I think it might muck up my workflow that I have right now.
Oh yeah.
So I really think it's worth some investigation, especially because like they do talk a lot about how, it's hard sometimes if you're trying to connect to AWS because of authentication challenges and stuff like that. I get it. Yep. So it supports integration with identity and access management and SIGv4.
Okay.
And then there's another MCP that they talk about called the MCP proxy for AWS, which bridges your IAM calls to OAuth for authentication. Probably, again, worth a look. I kind of think, you know how we've talked a lot about like sort of, I'll call it the tiers in AWS, right? They give us lots of primitives. Yeah. You can build whatever you want. And then they layer something on top of it. So you don't necessarily have to build that. And then they may maybe layer something else on top of it to get you even further away from the complexity. The other note that I wrote here as I was reading through this is it kind of feels like a managed service. Because you could do all of this stuff, but if you don't want to spend your time, right, tinkering around with it, then maybe this is the right way to do it because you can just use this MCP server with the MCP proxy server and authenticate with AWS, get latest documentation, all of that good stuff. So definitely worth a look. Yeah. I'll look at it.
Totally. I mean, yeah, it's like it's part of, so what's in the toolkit? It's the MCP server, the agent skills, and the agent plugins, it looks like.
Yeah, pretty much. So, yeah.
Yeah. I bet you if you, when you go to cut over to this on your workflows, you might be pleasantly surprised. But
maybe. You know, it's funny. We talk about this a lot, the idea of like you get used to an IDE. The likelihood of you changing just because a friend of yours says, have you seen this IDE? And you're like, yeah, I have. You're not going to make me change, right? And I'm so embedded in the Docker toolkit, you know, that sort of, I'm going to call it ecosystem now. I'm kind of like, oh, do I want to change it? Do I have to change it? I don't know. We'll see. But I think you're right. You might be pleasantly surprised. So it's probably worth a look.
Yeah.
And if it simplifies it.
Yeah, it looks like there's a plugin marketplace on Cloud you can use.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a new feature, but
yeah.
Yeah, it's just a // plugin marketplace add the toolkit essentially.
You mean right in Cloud Code you can do a / plugin command? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, right in Cloud Code.
Okay. That is not a new feature because I've used that for I've got like the design plugin, I've got there's like I want to call it the skills creator plugin. So if you make your own skill, you can then use the skills creator to say, look at what I've created. Is it good? And it'll actually build out, like, you know how the way Claude works is it doesn't load the whole skill. Like it basically just loads, I'll call it the metadata, right? It just knows there is skill there called X and it's got the description of that skill. And I stumbled across this because I built a skill and I kind of thought just using natural language, it would say, oh, I should just use that skill to do this. Mm. And it was kind of spotty. It would work sometimes. It wouldn't work the other time. So I kept kind of, well, I wasn't Googling it, but I was asking Claude to help me with it, right? And it finally said, you should look at the skill creator or whatever. And it was really neat because it did cost me a few extra bucks because you have to use the Claude API connection. But it's almost like the old days of building voice apps for the Echo device.
Oh, yeah.
You could like give it utterances and say, hey, if I said this, would it invoke the skill? If I said that, would it invoke the skill? And then it tries to create its own, and it goes off and makes a whole bunch of token calls on your behalf and costs you a few bucks, and then refines the metadata in your skill to make it sort of more likely to be invoked when you think it should be invoked. I thought it was pretty neat.
So you can actually run tests to see if your skill will get called. Okay, yeah. That's pretty sweet, actually.
Yeah, just like the old days when I was mucking around with voice skills, you could basically, in part of the design process, you could say, okay, these are the things, right? And here are some samples. Would they invoke the skill, right? Or not the skill? I guess, what did they call them back then?
Alexa skills.
Alexa skills. Remember, didn't we both take the certification, and then they shuttered it
immediately, like, sunset.
Yeah.
Pretty quickly. After that, yeah.
Just didn't go the way they thought, I guess. Right. All right. So what else do we have here? You shared an article about AI agents running on AWS or Amazon workspaces. Tell me about that one.
Oh yeah. So now there is first party support in Amazon Workspaces, which is essentially a managed desktop environment for coding agents to use with computer use capabilities. So what you can do now is, when you configure a workspace, you can configure it to be coding agents enabled or friendly, and it'll expose an MCP server that you can access via IAM auth, essentially.
Yeah.
So that's computer use for your agents if you want to run that in the cloud.
Yeah.
And that's just like
Go ahead.
I was gonna say, that's just like a desktop environment that you can run whatever on, essentially.
Yeah. I thought the write-up for this was really good, in the sense, like, it was easy to understand why this might be important, right? And the thing that I took away was that they said something like 3/4 of the organizations are still running on legacy applications that don't have sort of modern APIs. And then I can't remember the other thing was, like, it was close to 75% again of larger organizations might be still running applications on mainframes. So like, this idea of MCPs, APIs and stuff like that isn't really available because those are not modern applications. So now you're able to run, right? What was it? What do they call it? Computer vision, computer input. So it can click and all that stuff, see the desktop. I thought it was pretty cool. And it supports MCP integration somehow too, which that's the one part I couldn't quite figure out. They're like, also with MCP. And I was like, how do I know how that works? I didn't quite get that part.
I think that's how you access the workspaces, or how the agent accesses the workspaces.
Like, oh, really?
So you hook that into wherever you're running your agent loop, right? Mm. And then you have auth into the workspace to go and do. Or presumably, you can get like a screenshot of the current screen.
Yeah.
And then send mouse clicks, send keyboard input, I imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this might be worth a little kick of the can, just to see like how it's set up. I know there was a little demo, but again, it felt very light. Like, it was like, click here, do this, and then yay. And I was like, I bet you it's not that easy. It doesn't feel like it would be that easy, but I again, pretty cool. The other thing, I don't know if you stumbled across it, I couldn't find pricing for it, and I couldn't find anything that this is included in the cost of running your workspace. So I'm not quite sure.
As far as I can tell, it seems like it's there wasn't anything in the blog post anyways.
Yeah.
So at least the cost of one workspace.
And I actually clicked on the documentation link in the blog post and kind of scrolled in the little tiny section that they had for, you know, workspace agents or whatever they're calling it, trying to see a link to some pricing page. I could not find it. But, you know, if you're working in an environment with legacy applications and stuff like that, pretty neat.
Yeah, really neat. Yeah. That's a crazy stat, though. 75% of orgs on legacy apps. That's wild.
Yeah.
But I mean, I guess if you're a big bank, then you're kind of locked into running some of those COBOL systems, right? Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, yeah. What else did I write down? Oh, here's our favorite, a quality of life news release. Ooh. And what grabbed my attention was just, I saw the word EventBridge. So I've been doing a lot of EventBridge stuff recently on the little personal projects and stuff like that. And one of the things that I've often found with EventBridge, and I don't know if, be interested to see if you have the same opinion, but I often find EventBridge kind of feels like a black hole in the sense that I put an event onto the bus and it doesn't come out the other side. Right. And I'm like, okay, what did I do wrong? Like, how do I go find logs? Like, where is this thing? And I've often found it. I'm sure it's more user error than anything. Like, I'm sure some of this stuff has already existed, but damned if I could find it in when I needed it, right? So now what you're able to do is you can log EventBridge data plane API calls, or I'll call it data plane events. There we go. That's the word, to CloudTrail.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So like, you know, my comment to, as I was reading it, is more logs are always better. So, you know, not enabled by default. And because it's a data plane operation, you do have to make sure you understand the pricing, because that will increase the pricing of your CloudTrail implementation, right? Because management, I'm always trying to remember this, because I generally have people ask me, well, how much does CloudTrail cost? So you get one copy of your management events for free. If you make a second management trail, you pay per million events or something like that. And then unless it's changed, I kind of always say to people, any data plane events that you're writing to CloudTrail will incur some additional fees. Just be careful.
Yeah. Right? The management events are usually more expensive too. S3 is like $2 per 100,000 or something like that.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, if you're using a lot of event-driven solutions and EventBridge is part of it, right?
Makes sense.
Might be worth it.
Save you from the workflow of like setting up a Lambda function to spit out your events, which I know I've done before. You can set up logs for it, right?
But. Yeah, you can. Yeah, you can write to Cloud. I think you can write to CloudWatch logs too, right?
I think so.
The example that you just gave is generally what I do. Just send everything to this Lambda function, and all the function does is print event. And I'm like, okay, well, it got it. So now I can work backwards from there. But this might be helpful, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Any other AWS news that caught your eye this week?
Let's see. I don't think there was anything crazy besides that. Mostly just the agent SDK stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Well, we need some cool transition music now. Like to go from segment to segment, right?
I'll ask your friend for it.
I'll ask him to generate some segment transitions for us. So my favorite segment, personal projects. Any updates this week?
Ooh, updates, personal projects. I think I got multiplayer working on that game.
Oh, nice.
Like networked local net multiplayer.
Yeah.
So I'm going to test that out tonight, hopefully with my wife, and we'll see if we can get a game going.
Yeah.
And play test a little bit, and then we'll see how that goes. And then I got into Kaggle again. So are you familiar with Kaggle?
I think you've mentioned it before, but it's my brain is foggy. Tell me what this is.
It's like a data science learning / competition platform.
If
you're looking, if you're looking for good data sets, there's like a fair amount of available and useful data on Kaggle just to mess around with.
Okay.
But they also run competitions, so you can try and train agents for various things. You know, like one of them, I think the big AI prizes are on there, like the Arc AGI competitions and. Bunch of other interesting stuff, but I found one that was like train an agent to play this game where you're controlling these planets. You have to send these ships to go and capture other planets, like a RTS kind of game. So I'm messing around with that.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. You know where my personal project update will be.
It's how's the Kanban going?
It's always Kanban. I don't have anything else that I think about. I'm pretty happy with the progress that I made this week. So I've got my little Fargate cluster, right? And it will handle code now. So like I can create a card in Kanban that says go do X, right, on project Y or something.
Nice.
And it'll pick it up and there's some configuration you have to do, and it's a little clunky right now. So like when you create the card, if you can basically, I didn't come up with this name. I think it's a good name. Claude did. It calls it the dispatcher. So if you dispatch that card to essentially an agent, there's a little button, you click it, and then depending on the type of dispatch you want to run, and I'll tell you what I've created with Claude's help this week, but depending on what you select there, you have to fill in some details. Like if it's a code thing, it needs to know the repo, right? Because it needs to make the GitLab thing, GitLab call. It needs to have the GitLab token, which is stored in Secrets Manager, right? So it uses your project definition to go and make the connection to GitLab, but also go and find the token it needs. It's a little clunky. I haven't figured out how best to handle that. I'm kind of thinking I've got an account finder. I think I told you about this. So like if I'm working on something for a customer, I can tie it to an account. So I can say that's customer X's logging account. And it gives me a deep link to get over to their account quickly if I need to. So I just click that. I don't have to remember, right? So I was kind of thinking that I could do something very similar. Like I've got a client page that has all their accounts, and I'm kind of thinking, okay, well, along with that, it could have all of the Git projects. So instead of having to fill it all in, I would just get a drop down because it's tied to a particular customer. And then I could have a drop down that just says, here's all the projects, and you could just select the right project. And behind the scenes, it's got the URL it needs. It knows how to go and find the token out of Secrets Manager. So I need to fix that, but it works. So I can go in there and I can say, I want you to look at issue 12 and fix it. And the issue is actually still in GitLab. So there's another little weird thing there. So I'm working on that. But I got it working and I thought, oh, I wonder what else I could do with this. And I think I mentioned last week doing like research. So somebody asks me a question about service Y. I don't want to read documentation. I want somebody else to read the documentation, give me the Coles notes, and then I'm going to go and verify it. So you've got that now as another sort of, I'll call it an action. So when you say a dispatch, I say, hey, this is a research item, and I give it a description and it goes and it comes back and updates the card with what it found, including source information and everything. And then the last thing is, and this again needs a little tweaking, but there's a doc dispatcher now. So I can kind of tell it, hey, we've a whole bunch of MRs have landed today. You and I haven't updated the documentation, right? You being the agent. This is a documentation dispatcher. Go look at all the MRs that landed today, compare it to the documentation and make any updates. And you don't have to ask me, just do it. I don't like the fact that I have to tell it to do that. I think would be better that it had some sort of built-in logic to say, hey, a whole bunch of MRs landed today. I should probably just update this and do it. But it's been a fun little exercise to see how it works.
I feel like you could just have a hook in there, or even like a cron every day at the end of the day, go through all my merge requests that came in or that I pushed through. Whereas anything, are there any doc updates that need to be done? If so, do them.
I think you're right. Because all of those, all of the merge records and everything, all the MRs and everything, they all get jammed into OpenBrain so that when I ask an agent, look at the Kanban project and tell me where it is, it's not going to GitLab. It's looking in OpenBrain and saying, hey, this is what you did yesterday. So you're right. Like I could just have a schedule happening there that just says, hey, at the end of the day, there's these five mood lighting, man.
I'm going to match your...
There you go.
Purple,
I got purple. Look at that.
The background.
Well, yeah. We talk before the show to make sure our lighting scheme matches. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. I think like I could have like a cron job in there that just says, hey, these are all the projects. Go and look at the documentation every day at midnight and just check it against the MRs and update it. So that's all done. I've spent too much time in the Kanban board again, but you know, I wrote an article about it, and it's really just a great way I think I've mentioned this. It's a great way to just learn how this stuff works. The one thing I didn't get done that I really wanted to be able to come back and tell you about was the sort of router idea. Like, not everything needs to be Opus 4.7.
Yeah.
So I cheaped out, and it does have that logic now. But what I've done is I've just hard coded it. So I say, if it's a code, I want you to use Opus, right?
Yeah.
Actually, no, sorry, I'm saying that backwards. If it's research, I want you to use Opus because I want you to think about it, right? Go and get me real stuff. If it's code, I use Sonnet. And if it's documentation, I'm actually trying Haiku. I think it's maybe a little light. So I might change that to Sonnet as well. But I've just hard coded them for now. It just pulls in the right model. So it works. Nice. But I want a little more logic, and I also want to see if I can start using some of the models that you talk about, like Mini and Minimax. Is it Minimax and Kimi?
Oh, yeah. Minimax 2.7 is still really good.
Yeah.
And Kimi K just came out with 2.6 as well. So
yeah, it's amazing, how fast these models are changing. Constantly.
It's week by week.
Stuff. I know, right? So yeah, I've made a lot of good progress on it again. I do think I need some other hobby at this point, but...
Sometimes I wonder.
Yeah. I also need content for Wednesday nights, though. So
exactly.
You know, so it's sort of it's the content flywheel. Anyways, okay, so that's personal projects. Unless you got anything else you want to chat about.
What else I've been working on? I don't know. Just back to the Kanban thing. I mean, it sounds like you can just have like a per customer context, essentially, that you're fetching. And then that gets you all your Git repos and stuff. But yeah, the orchestration piece is, it's fun. I don't know.
Yeah. You know what, man? It's I kind of thought when I started down this path, it started with Open Brain. And I kind of thought that would be the thing that I would spend all the time on, trying to figure it out and tweak it and stuff. But in the end, it's a vector store in Postgres, right? Yeah. And once you kind of get the scoring sorted out, like, so that it's giving you something that's relevant if you're doing a search, like, it does what I want it to do. If I opened up Kiro and asked it for something, it would know. If I opened up Gemini and asked it would know. But the Kanban tied to things like the account finder, like, I spend my entire day in Kanban now. Like, my whole life is in there, and it's all... It just seeds everything into Open Brain or pulls context out of Open Brain. It's amazing. It's just a front end for my vector store is really what it's turned into.
Yeah. Well, there's whole companies coming up now that are essentially just that, right?
Yeah.
Like, what is it? Automatic or like Factory or something. I can't remember the name of the company, but they're essentially just like a workflow for orchestrating long running agents. Right. So that's becoming a thing. And I'm sure the labs are working on their versions of that as well, but
yeah. Yeah, I actually built a little UI for Open Brain, thinking I would go in there and look at the context. And I don't think I've used it once. What's that called? Yagni? You're never going to use this? And
yeah,
I'm like, no, this will be cool. And don't use it, right? Because I'm always in Kanban and it gets all the context. So, pretty neat. Okay, where do we want to go? Gen AI news. The first one that I had on my list was Mozilla and testing out Mythos, and it found 271 zero-day vulnerabilities in the latest version of Firefox.
Crazy.
Yeah.
That's a lot of vulnerabilities.
Yeah, that's a lot of stuff. So, I don't know how many weeks ago it was we talked about Mythos, and I chuckled. There was a single comment on YouTube, and somebody said, Mythos is a myth. And I'm like, I didn't bother responding. I'm like, all right, I had a chuckle, and I moved on. Well, it found 271 vulnerabilities, and they did a test to see how much Opus would find. Opus 4.6 found 22.
Yeah. So, it's not to say that Opus can't find these things, right? But like, Mythos is clearly tuned.
But
specifically,
what is that,
for...
7 times?
Yeah.
So, I don't
know. Mind you, 4.7, they purposely nerfed that capability, right? But like...
Well, yeah.
Everything I've heard in CyberSec, like from industry experts, are saying, yeah, this is a real thing and we need to pay attention. to these vulnerabilities because they're real.
Yeah, 271 vulnerabilities. That's not a small number. They didn't really the what did I write down the CTO the his name was in the article. I don't remember now. Didn't mention any details about what was found, or they didn't speculate on how maybe it was finding these things. The only real thing they said was it found a lot of shit, and we tried it with Opus 4.6 as well, and it's nowhere near as capable of doing what it's doing. So I don't really think there's much else to say about that. It found a bunch of stuff.
Browser code bases are like millions of lines of code, right? To
Yeah.
render this the web as you know it. Like, so it shouldn't be that surprising that like an automatic system that can, pattern match and find those vulnerabilities, if you throw it through that whole code base, that it will find a few things. That would take like an expert maybe a lot longer to cover to come up with, right? So
Yeah, pretty good. Okay, what's next? Oh, you had shared something, and I did not get to read this. It looked like pricing for DeepSeek, some new DeepSeek models.
Yeah, a new DeepSeek model or a new series of DeepSeek models dropped. DeepSeek V4, V4 Pro, V4 Flash, and this just kind of I just wanted to talk about this a little bit just because of the price differential compared to like the top models, right? Because we just got a couple of new releases and they're pretty. I mean, they're not cheap models, right? Like 4.7 and 5.5 specifically. So Claude Opus 4.7 is $5 per million in, 25 per million out. And then GPT 5.5 is $5 in and then 30 out. And then DeepSeek V4 Pro is $1.74 in and 3.48 out. And then DeepSeek V4 Flash is 14 cents in and 28 cents out. Now, it's the important thing is like intelligence per dollar, right? That's what you really care about for the most part. So where does that stack up? So DeepSeek V4 Flash is about as capable as Gemini 3 Flash and, cheaper by about half, I think, on the intelligence benchmarks. And DeepSeek V4 Pro is about on par with Minimax 2.7, Qwen 3.6 max, a little bit better than GPT 5.4 mini on extra high, for context, and like slightly under Kimi-K 2.6. And it's priced about the same in the same ballpark as Kimi-K 2.6. So
So,
just to,
just insanely cheaper, but you'd have to make
yeah.
sure, to your point, that it's the model lines up with the capabilities that you might be used to already in another model that you're
Yeah, that's the
probably
thing.
paying more
So
for.
probably. So if you're just defaulting to GPT 5.5 or Opus 4.6 or 4.7 for all your tasks, you're probably giving up like you it you probably have some waste in your process that you could eliminate by switching to a cheaper model, right? It's just do you do the legwork to go and figure out which model works?
I'm going to go back to my IDE analogy. I think I can speak from my own experience. Like, lock-in is not the right word, but you start getting so used to a workflow and that it just works. I kind of think of it as like an IDE lock-in. You get so used to it that you're like, is the effort to switch, well, what's the saying? Is the juice worth the squeeze, right? Like, is it actually worth me going to do that? But on the flip side, you could think of the benefits of just understanding the other models and being able to, again, keep stealing analogies, right? The right tool for the right job, to borrow from Amazon, is like, just because you have access to a state-of-the-art model doesn't mean that you should be using that state-of-the-art model for everything.
Well, it's really interesting too. Like, it's kind of like Anthropic has been the king in the enterprise B2B space, right? And I think a lot of that is because they were available on Bedrock first. Like, if you're on the cloud providers, you're way more likely to be used in enterprise, right? But GPT-5 is now on Bedrock as well, so it'll be interesting to see how that affects usage.
Yeah.
And the more of these models they add to Bedrock, the more options your company has to just,
Yeah.
experiment,
You know
play
what?
around,
I
maybe
think it
save
would
some
be a
costs.
yeah, save money. That's the thing, right? Like, I think it would be a really interesting metric, and I'm sure there's reasons why this doesn't exist, but like, what are the usage metrics for the different models that are available on Bedrock? Like, 'cause they keep adding new stuff, right? Like there's a bunch of open weighted models on there now that you can use. It would I would I don't know if this stat exists. Maybe it does, and I'm just not looking in the right spot. But I think it would be interesting to see, like, very, very similar to what they would do, like, on, when the companies would do sort of analysis on GitHub. And here are the programming languages that are the ones that everybody are using. Like, I want to know, out of the 10 billion requests that went to Bedrock last month, what is the percentage breakdown of those 10 billion requests? Like, which models are being used? I think that'd be
Totally.
really cool to know.
Yeah, I wish they would publish that. I think
Yeah.
the closest you can get, right, is OpenRouter, who they kind of do that for all of
Oh,
their
yeah.
providers.
Yeah.
So you might be able to filter down to Bedrock on there, and that's only through OpenRouter though.
Yeah.
So you won't actually see the true numbers for Bedrock proper, but that would be really cool. I would
Yeah.
like to see those numbers.
Yeah, that would be neat, right? I don't see there's any reason why they would ever tell anybody that info, but I think it would be kind of interesting to know what people are using. Yeah. Very cool.
So this,
Oh, go ahead.
yeah, just I wanted just something I wanted to share, just taking a look at the price per cost to run versus intelligence chart on artificial analysis is what I'm looking at for determining these metrics, right? And
Yeah, man. I think I say this every week. I need to use Codex, and I need to figure out some models that aren't Claude.
Yeah.
All right, just to try them out.
5.5. 5.5 is good. It's
Yeah.
good, but it is expensive. But it's expensive. It's more token efficient, but it's really good on low and medium. Like if you use it on the low settings, it's like just a really snappy, kind of fast tool just for getting through quick code problems. So that's been my go-to.
It's again, like, I was really impressed with Gemini when they came out with was it the Gemini 3 models, maybe 3
Oh yeah.
Flash or something, like how fast that was. And again, like, there's just so many options. It's interesting just to kind of, I guess, experimentation is key. You got to try some stuff out, compare the stuff to, compare the models against each other, and just find the stuff that makes sense for what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, and it's even like you there was an interesting thing I read about using multiple different models or model providers for various parts of the workflow, right? So if you're using different providers for coding, for verification, for planning, and that's part of like your pipeline, you are getting the benefit of you're not gated by the floor of one of those of only using one set of models, right? So something because the capabilities are kind of jagged across all the models, you're kind of insulating yourself from that problem, which is interesting.
Yeah, really neat. Okay, what's next on my list? Oh, I stumbled across, I apologize if I didn't share this one with you. I said before we started, I've just been crappy with sharing this week. I don't know where the week has gone. So I was like
It's flying.
just minding my own business, and I was like, it's Wednesday, man. Like, you have shit to do. You better. So I think we've talked about this before. Two of the technical blogs that I really am enjoying right now are Docker and Cloudflare.
Oh, yeah.
And I came across a Docker post about how, again, they've talked about Docker sandboxes and how they've built a system on top of Docker sandboxes. So let's just refresh anybody's memory that might be listening on what that is. So essentially, what Docker has done is created this sandbox environment, which is, they describe it as micro VMs, right? That allow you to run them completely isolated from the underlying host. And on inside those sandboxes, they have full autonomy. They can do whatever they want, but they can't touch your host. Okay. So that's been around for a while. And what they've done now is they've created something they call a fleet. And they describe it in the blog post as a virtual team of 7 agents with different roles that you can use to help test your products, you know, triage issues, even do things like posting release notes, like documentation and stuff like that. Really interesting. And as I got into it, I didn't write all of this down, but it's worth a read. I'll share it in the show notes after. It's essentially built on Claude Code skills. So there's a whole list of skills they've created, and those are then available to the fleet to use as you task it. And it also uses something that we've talked about a bunch of times, the Ralph loop.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. Right. So it just basically keeps asking the questions and iterating through those responses from the different agents until it's happy with the response, I guess. That's the kind of the way I think of it. I'm not sure if that's exactly fair to what a Ralph loop is, but a pretty neat little system that's all available for you to use.
That's really cool. It kind of feels like everyone's solving the same problem right now.
How
do you orchestrate it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, how do you orchestrate multiple agents to do the work that you want them to do?
Yeah. Yeah. If somebody's not trying to build an open claw, replacement isn't the right word, but they're trying to build their own version of that. If they're not doing that, they're, it seems like, you know, how do you deal with fleets of agents? I don't know who it was, but we both speculated end of 25 that 2026 was going to be the year of the agent. Right. And I think that's what we're seeing. It's just everything we talk about is agents now. That's all it is.
you can't hide from it. Yeah.
No. Everywhere. Yeah. So I thought that was neat. This idea of sandboxing, because I've used so much Docker now, the irony, I was talking to somebody the other day, you know this too, I've always been kind of meh about container-based applications, right? I'm like, if you're going to build something brand new, why don't you just go serverless, go 100% serverless, like Lambda and stuff like that? Why do you want to mess with a container? But it's unbelievable how much container work I do now, just based off of all the things we talk about here every week. It's all Docker.
I mean, as soon as you get to a team more than like three developers, right? Mm-hmm. Even two developers, you need to make sure that the environment is the same somehow. And it's like, guess what? Lambda is all Docker or essentially containers on the backside anyways, right?
Yeah.
Firecracker, what have you.
Yeah. You just don't see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty cool. So any thoughts you want to share on that one? I know I kind of dropped it on you at the last second, but anything that comes up to mind?
No, this is cool. I mean, again, it's that orchestration loop, right? Like, so you've got essentially seven CI/CD AI rules. Mm-hmm. And what are they doing? There's a tester, a performance tester, an upgrade tester, project manager, software engineer. So it's kind of what we've been talking about. Like, how do you build kind of like the framework around a coding agent to actually create useful, good code? Mm-hmm. And people are trying to solve that problem, it seems like.
Yep. Yeah, I thought it's neat. And I think, again, like it's got to be on my not necessarily fleets, but this idea of sandboxes, right? And kind of kicking the tires a little bit more with that. It reminds me again of a lot of times of like Python virtual environments. Do not touch Python on my operating system. Thank you very much. But whatever reason, we've all been, I don't say we all, but like, I think there's a lot of people that are working in very isolated environments, but I think the majority of folks seem perfectly okay with putting that agent on their desktop and letting it access whatever they want. But then it's like, if you think about Python, you're like, just don't touch that, right? Everything's in a virtual environment. Don't touch anything. But this, for whatever reason, seems people approach it differently.
Yeah, that's weird. So I wouldn't want anything touching. Like, please do not break my... my home Python install.
No, just, oh my just God. Do you just setting yourself up for endless pain, right? Oh man. Okay, you shared something, Google selling TPUs to a select group of customers.
Yeah, this is just a quick hit news item. So Google's TPUs or Tensor Processing Units is their in-house AI chip, right? Mm-hmm. Seems like they're planning to sell them to select customers, as they said, this year, said in the earnings call, which is kind of interesting. There's not that many companies out there that can make this kind of chip. I guess it makes sense.
Makes sense. There's gotta be, you know, a ton of money to be made.
Oh yeah.
With these chips. So they're not going to sit there and not try to take advantage of that. Right.
Totally. I'm kind of curious, like the cost benefit of whether you keep them in house and put them in your data centers or, you know, sell them to customers for a huge mark or competitors for a huge markup. Right. Or do you sell them as like kind of an edge setup in their data centers as like what's the AWS version? There's essentially edge racks you can rent, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Regardless. So
my thought on all this stuff is it reminds me of economics 101, right? It's that good old supply and demand curve. And somebody sits down, as I say every week, it simply comes down to a math problem. And somebody says, there is too much money to be made in not selling these chips right now, right? Like, yes, they may give us some sort of advantage over everybody else, but look at the benefits of selling these on the market, especially right now when there seems to be nothing available. And then the next part of my brain goes, well, if they're willing to sell that, what do they really have? You know what I mean? Like, like, you know, what's that space plane? I'm totally off topic, but like the X-37B. And somebody shared a picture and they're like, hey, there's some great pictures from Artemis. This is cool. But everybody seems to forget that the X-37B plane has been circling the Earth at some crazy altitude for like the last year and a half. And it's up there doing who knows what. And I often think about like a military analogy, right? The moment you see the stealth fighter at your local air show, that probably means there's something way better than what they're flying over your local air show. So I kind of, when I saw you share this, I'm like, okay, if they're selling those chips, do they have better chips that they're still just they're theirs? And now they're willing to sell these crappy old things. You can have them now, right? I'm just having fun with it. But those are the two things that pop into my head. Simple supply demand curve. And what do you have that you're not selling at this point?
Really?
Yeah. And if you don't know anything about the X-37B space plane, you should definitely spend your evening looking at it. It is very cool stuff. Very definitely. Cool. Yeah. Okay. Who's next? Simon Willison. I hope I shared this with you. And he came up with this idea of the difference between vibe coding and what he called agentic engineering. And the idea was that vibe coding, you didn't really care. You had an idea, you built it, it was for you, it didn't matter, right? If it didn't work, you fixed it. It didn't bother a bunch of your users. Yeah, you just did your stuff. I tend to call that on the show personal projects, right? Personal software. Yeah. It's just for me or a very small group of people. And then his definition of agentic engineering was much more rigid, you know, formed on years of good software development and design practices. Yes, you weren't writing the code, but you reviewed every line of code. And this article was that those two terms are getting too close, that, you know, these are my thoughts on what he said. So I'm hoping I interpreted this correctly. But he basically made a comment that the line between vibe coding, sort of as I've roughly defined, and agentic engineering is increasingly getting blurred as the quality of the AI coding agents becomes better and better. And he even mentions that even though he's a proponent of this idea of agentic engineering, right? He's now not even looking at code.
Yeah.
Which I think says a lot, right?
Yeah. It's something I've noticed too. To be honest here, have you actually looked at the code implementation of specific like classes in your Kanban setup or whatnot, right?
No.
And it's like, I haven't looked at the actual code implementation for this game I'm working on really yet, because it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah.
I just need that the logic is implemented to the game rules, essentially, right? Yeah. But it's like, it's getting good enough that you don't have to care that much about it.
Yeah.
I'm sure, like, for important, like for medical devices, you're going to want to be that'll be outside the realm of vibe coding probably for a lot longer, I imagine, or like nuclear,
I would hope
actually, like,
so.
you would hope so, right? You
Yeah.
really want you really don't you would really want to
Yeah.
avoid
I'm gonna vibe code the water cooling system for the nuclear
Oh no.
reactor. Yeah, probably not something you want to ever hear, right? So, but yeah, it's amazing to see how it's changed. So on your question about looking at the code, and this relates back to the article, do you feel guilty about not looking at that code?
Sometimes, right? Because I feel like there's an element of craft almost
Yeah.
that, but like maybe I'm just being ridiculous, and I was never that good of a programmer anyways.
Yeah. I'm with you. I will say I was never that good of a programmer, right? And that's, I think, one of the things that I really enjoy about AI now is like I was a competent programmer. Like if you gave me, well, it's what we've done for 10 years with customers, right? If you gave me a task, I could code that and get it to work for you. Was it the most elegant solution compared to somebody else? No, it wasn't, but it got the job done. And even Simon Wilson says like he feels guilty that he's not looking at the code anymore. And I can honestly say to you that I used to feel guilty, and every once in a while it creeps back. But I think I've been doing this sort of, the five levels, dark factory, right? Stuff, even though I'm not really doing dark factory, but trying to stay as close to that as possible. I think I've been doing it long enough now where I'm just like, meh. It hits me every once in a while. I'm like, but if somebody asked you about that, could you tell them? And I'm like, no, but I don't know if I necessarily need to because I could have Claude tell them what it is. And I have the design docs. I've done all the design. I've brainstormed with Claude's help on what I expect it to do, how I expect it to work, what it should look like, all the stuff that I don't believe an agent at this point can do like a human can do. But that agent can write way more code than I can, way better code than I can. And I don't know if I necessarily feel guilty about it anymore.
Yeah, like as long as you understand deeply the system design parameters
You
and
got it.
decisions that you're making, doesn't matter that much, you know? And that's why people are trying to work around it by implementing TDD well for agents, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah,
There's
yeah.
plenty of skills out there and big repos about how do you do that well for your various agentic coding systems.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's like we weren't like going to go off and write FFmpeg in assembly, right? You know? But we
No.
could write a web app just fine that works.
Yeah.
Like we could stand up something useful for a
Yeah.
customer
People could
and
use it, right?
production ready, right?
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. He also in the article has a really great analogy on how he's starting to think about how he is making, I'm going to put words in his mouth because I don't know exactly if this is what he meant, but how he's starting to come to feeling okay about not writing all the code. And he uses an analogy of when he used to work at a large organization, right? And maybe the tools that he was using every day were not written by him. They were written by somebody else. And it's not like he would take those tools and go through every single line of that code before he used them. He just used them. The other team would provide documentation and he just used the code. And if he ran into problems, he would refer to the documentation or you'd open a support ticket or talk to the team that wrote it to try to figure out why it didn't work. But it was a black box, right? And he didn't worry that he didn't know every line of code, and he's using that same sort of approach now, I guess, to deal with his guilt. I think for people like us that have been working in this space for so long, I think there's a little bit of nostalgia. Like it's just not the same unless you're writing it, right? Like I get feelings of nostalgia when I see skateboarding videos because I spent half of my teenage years doing that, right? And I get over it very quickly because my rational brain says if you stepped on that skateboard now, something would break. So just, yeah, you can't relive your youth. So just move on. Don't be nostalgic about it. And I think this is kind of the same thing. I think you have to embrace it and you have to come up with the way to feel okay about not writing every line of code. You're still responsible for that code,
That's meaning the thing.
You have to have good design principles and understanding best practices on where that code is going to run and what it has to do. But that doesn't mean you have to write every line of code anymore.
Totally.
Yeah.
I think how I'm going to get over it is I'm just going to go and do some more practice problems. just going to go do admin of code or whatnot. I still ought to do this.
You still ought to do this? See, okay. It's so funny how everybody's dealing with it in their own way. I'm just like, I don't care. Like, I'm going to go and work in my garden. And then I'm going to, when I come back, I expect Claude, those 4 MRs to be ready for me to review. And the other really interesting thing in his article is he sort of makes a statement on what he thinks the new bottleneck is. Mm. And he thinks the bottleneck is design.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I can see that. It depends on where you're, it's like human attention, right? Like, where can you focus on, basically, for me?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
How much can I pay attention to?
Yeah. His analogy is that you don't want your agents working on the wrong things for extended periods of time. And that means you have to have proper design in place. Otherwise, those agents might go off in a direction that you didn't want them to go in. And the way you kind of try to, I'm going to use the term guardrail or corral them a little bit, is good design, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
It's funny with these things, though, how as much as things have changed, they really haven't. Because this is something I used to talk, like in the early days of AWS. I'm like, you've got hundreds of services. And, you know, even today, it's basically a mix of APIs or primitives. And you can put them together in all sorts of different ways to do whatever it is that you want, but you better understand those services and you better understand the outcome of what it is you're trying to do now, because you don't want to be 6 months into a project. And I always used to use the analogy of painting yourself into the corner of a room, right? So you're just merrily going along, right? Painting away. And then you realize that you backed yourself into a corner and you're 6 months into the project. You know, I still think that analogy holds water with this, is you want to spend the time up front and design that solution in a way that meets your objectives, and then let the agents go do it, but make sure that those agents are adhering to those really well-defined design parameters, like what you expect the system to do. And I thought it was a really good article, like, as usual, worth a read, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Everything that comes out of that blog is worth a read.
Worth a read. Pretty much. Worth a read. I only have a couple things left. Do you have anything on your list? I know you shared a couple extra things we haven't talked about. Is there anything from the channel you want to share?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So I found a couple of security breaches that were interesting.
Okay.
For one thing, there was a Palo Alto zero-day remote code execution on their firewalls. That's worth knowing about.
Yeah,
not great. The good news is it was for a kind of what they call like a what's the word? An important portal. It's like a critical portal for firewall access, right? So as long as you don't have that exposed to the public internet, you're probably okay. Mm-hmm. But the CVE was a buffer overflow that lets you execute remote code on kind of an exposed portal, and there's a captive portal attack, so something to be aware of with your Palo Alto firewalls. You probably want to update those.
Yeah. Anything else?
Not great.
No, not great. No, not great.
Let's see. There was another interesting blog post by, I don't know if you had the time to read this one, but there was an Anthropic bioinformatics research blog post that I found really interesting.
No, I didn't. But you reminded me of another thing that I found in the blog. So go ahead, and then I'm gonna add one extra thing.
Okay. So this was essentially, it's a write-up of how do you gauge the capabilities of LLMs for bioinformatics, bioengineering tasks, right? So essentially what they did was they took a cohort of experts in the domain, or various bio domains, and put together a set of questions, tested them against the humans. The humans gave their responses, right? And then there's a group of easy to solve questions for humans and a group of hard questions for human experts. And then they ran the various Anthropic models against those questions. And essentially what they found was For the easy questions, there's like a 80% hit rate at best for the suite of models. I think that's on Mythos as like number one. And then on the human hard questions, Mythos scored at most 30%. And then I think like Sonnet scored like 20%, Opus scored a little bit higher than that, which is kind of interesting to see. But I think the really interesting, so I guess what that means is, and I just got some notes here, but that means that models are now also useful collaborators for scientific biological work in the biology space, which is interesting. And they also solve some tasks that the human panel couldn't solve, which was kind of interesting. And there's also like a kind of interesting double-edged sword going on. So because there's like a huge knowledge base in the model of like the scientific literature in these domains, for a lot of questions that helps a lot, but for some questions they kind of get caught up and go down the wrong path, which I thought was funny.
Just like a human.
Just like, yeah, kind of.
You just get on the wrong path and you refuse to change.
The other interesting thing was that on the hard questions, they were brittle on getting them right. So it's like one out of five times they would get the question correct, right? Unless you stacked methods. So you can specify, kind of the takeaway from this whole thing is you can specify use multiple different methods to confirm this when you're running these, solving these problems. And if you can confirm with multiple different methods, then you have a better, more likely successful result, right? So
Well, that's neat.
kind of interesting.
Very cool. So the other thing that I ran across very just before we kind of started the episode was there was a blog post on Anthropic's blog. Thanks, Captain Obvious. My brain is slowly stopping here. That basically said they've signed an agreement with SpaceX to consume
Okay.
all of their compute power.
Wow.
So like in one of the big data centers, right, where they've got all of their GPUs and
What is that?
everything, Anthropic is,
Colossus or something?
yeah, something like that. I think it's called Colossus.
Okay.
Yeah, they're basically consuming it all.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So again, my immediate thought is, well, but what about Elon's AI
What
agent?
about
Is he
Grok?
not gonna he's does he have no computing power left at this point to continue to train that models model? Anthropic's just taken it all.
I mean, if you've ever used Grok,
I have not.
and I think that's the answer right there.
Yeah, I have not. I still have my Twitter account, but I'll still call it Twitter, and it's just locked and it just sits there. For one day, it will rise again. But for now, not going to go there. So no. But I just thought that was interesting because we just talked last week. What was the deal that Anthropic signed with AWS on the massive compute power, and now they're gobbling all of that up. And the interesting other part in that article was they specifically call out that that horsepower will be not given to, but will be prioritized for pro Mac subscribers. Because to make sure that it's, I guess, a little more reliable, a little more responsive, maybe. Because I know over the last 2 weeks, right, it's not necessarily been smooth sailing. You're working away, and it's just gone, and then it'll come back a little later, right? You start getting 503 errors or something like that. So they also called out that's where it's going. So
Well, this is what they did an announcement about like rate limits going up too, so this is probably why I
yeah.
remembered.
Yeah, so
So
that was the other thing in the article. They talk about like
okay.
how much your rate limits are going up, your weekly rate limits. They've got like the daily limits are going up as well. So they've got access to a bunch more compute power, I guess.
It's crazy that it is more economical for XAI to rent this out to Anthropic than to use it for their own models.
Yeah,
But
maybe
here we are, I
maybe that goes back to that simple supply demand graph again, and
guess.
maybe it also says something about the demand for the other model that might have been using all of that compute power at some point. Maybe it's just not there. You'll never know, right? But it's fun to
Yeah, we'll
speculate.
never know.
Yeah. Okay, so I have one more article which I thought was fun, and then we'll do recommendations. This one I'm like 95% sure I shared, and it was from Anden Labs, and they had an
Oh, yeah.
AI run a cafe in Stockholm. Did you read this?
I
This is
did read.
just, I don't care. This is just
Funny.
fun, right? So first off, of course, the agent has to have its a name, right? And I want to say, funnily enough, I didn't write it down in my notes. Was it Mona, I think,
It
right?
was Mona, yep.
Mona.
Yeah.
So Mona found the physical location, signed the lease. Okay. I guess I can't remember if they said this was in Switzerland or Sweden. Doesn't matter. A European
Sweden, I
country,
think, yeah.
Sweden, a European country that you require something they called a bank ID for doing certain things. So obviously
Oh.
Mona doesn't have a bank ID.
Right.
So she started essentially trying to figure out ways around having to provide a bank ID. So signing agreements for, like, I think the example was like internet connectivity. If you went to company A, you needed a bank ID. It doesn't have it, so it found company
Right.
B that would let it sign an agreement without a bank ID. And they even said in some cases she was a little shady about how she managed to get it done, but got it done. Also, it started impersonating people at the lab, like
Oh
basically
no.
saying, "Hey, I'm Joe," right? Even though they had
Yeah.
said to Mona multiple times, "Do not impersonate any real person." Kind of hard to control the agent from doing that. Very
Yeah.
focused on completing tasks, right? And posted job openings on LinkedIn, on Indeed, reviewed resumes, and even scheduled in-person interviews. And
With who?
then it realized that it couldn't do in-person interviews, so it switched those interviews to telephone calls instead.
Okay.
And hired people, hired multiple baristas, and turned down applicants who would like reference PhDs and stuff like that because it was like, hey, you're overqualified. You got lots of skills, pr probably not the skills that I need you to have to run fancy cafe equipment. So thanks, but no
Right.
thanks. Right? Manage these employees completely through Slack. Right? So you're not going to go see them. You don't exist. Set up commercial accounts for basically the purchases that would happen in a cafe for, like,
Sure.
bakery goods and stuff like that, but has messed
Napkins, that
up
kind of thing.
multiple times,
Okay.
basically leaving the cafe without things that it might need. So struggling there a little bit. Also struggles with ordering supplies. Like, there were a couple examples, ordering industrial garbage bags that they couldn't use anywhere, ordering thousands of napkins, right? They're like, napkins, these napkins will last us for a year. We don't need all these. So messing around with that. But it has been running the cafe for 2 weeks, and it also is in the process of making business deals with other people
Oh.
who are sending in emails that are interested in what's happening. And the really cool part is it's making business deals with other agents.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it actually had a Google Meet meeting with another agent who had emailed them to understand the experience that agent, Mona, had had running the lab, running the cafe.
Fascinating. So it's like
Right?
it's going to start running seminars.
Yeah, this is how you run a business if you're an AI agent. Remember those? I don't know
Crazy.
if I'm older than you, so I remember late night TV. There was always like some sort of infomercial, right? And I remember this
Oh,
one. It was a
sure.
guy like on a yacht, and he would always be like showing all the checks that people sent him as he's lounging on his yacht, right? And I just envision an AI agent having an infomercial late at night, right? Advertising to other AI agents who might see this on how they can make check after check of money from humans while running your own
Call now.
business. Yeah, call now. Only $72 in 3 easy installments, right?
Send Bitcoin to this address.
Yeah, there you go. There's nothing shady about that. So I don't know if you want to. It made me smile, man. I don't know what you think about it, but I had a good laugh when I was reading it.
it's the next level of the vending bench, right? It's pretty much the exact same framework, except it's really interesting that it was able to go out and solve the problem of how do I get a business license or not, or work around not having a business license? How do you actually hire people? The hiring people is particularly interesting, and so is the bank account thing. Like, how did it get an account with which to, work the money that you're making?
Yeah, I don't
So.
know. I don't know. Maybe like I'm not saying anything about any of these vendors, but like how hard is it? And I don't know, but how hard is it to sign up for a Stripe account? Like how much info, I don't know. Like how much info do you need to give them nowadays to open up Stripe? Like I don't know. Never used any of those payment processors, but I bet you there are more than one out there that are maybe a little less stringent on the info they get from you. Right? Just
Yeah, I wonder if you
speculating. I
can
have no
connect
idea.
Stri connect Stripe to like PayPal or something like that. I wonder.
Or maybe it was able to figure out, all these different point of sales solutions now that are all just like, scan and tap solutions. Maybe there's a merchant that allows you to set those up. Who knows, right? But it figured it out.
It was ordering. I mean, obviously, it was able to order, equipment. 3,000 nitrile gloves, apparently. So,
Yeah, and
congratulations.
it also said something about they or it ordered like 3,000 eggs, even though they said we don't have facilities to cook eggs. So like,
No eggs.
no eggs. Stop ordering eggs, right? I just say no. And you know what? It's funny that that came up. One last quick thing: a YouTube video came up, and it's I should know this person's name. She's a math. I'm pretty sure she's a mathematician. She does a lot of interviews on the Google DeepMind channel. And I think it was just last week, her and some of her colleagues set up OpenClaw. There we go. We got OpenClaw into the episode in the last 2 minutes. Set up OpenClaw and tasked it with running its own business. And it did the same thing. Like it set everything up and it was selling novelty mugs and stuff like that. And they had a very similar experience with it. It impersonated people. Like send, and then they're like, "Don't do this." So it made its own name up, right? So then it was Cass, I think they called it. It called itself. What else did it do? They actually had some of the mugs that it had ordered, and some of the it was all technology jargon and stuff. Some of it was kind of funny. What else did it do? They said if it couldn't make a sale in the next 48 hours, they would shut it down, and it sent hundreds of emails. Like to different vendors, to reporters and stuff, trying to drum up some interest to make a sale because it didn't want to be shut off.
Oh
Didn't
my
do it,
God.
didn't make a sale, but again, a really neat little experiment on what you can do with these agents. It wasn't all good, right? It did some weird stuff. Yeah. They asked it to order paper clips for some reason, and it did order paper clips, but there was something it had to do to order the paper clips. So, like, instead of $50 to get a bunch of paper clips, like it was $250 or something. So it like w overpaid for stuff. So, but they gave it a visa and all that to basically do stuff that it needed to do. Fun thought experiments, I think. It makes for good content too. It's a fun read to see what people are trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, you could theoretically just set up, spin up a totally AI kind of. I mean, it wouldn't be a super substantial business, but like a merch business for like print-on-demand stuff. Like, there's companies make mug or let you submit designs for mugs and shirts and whatnot, and you could probably set up something that just churns that out automatically, and then probably you'll get banned on Etsy or whatever, but
Eventually,
eventually.
yeah, because it'd probably be a bunch of copyrighted stuff that doesn't care, right?
Probably.
So yeah, somebody's like, "You can't say that. That's my slogan. It's trademarked." All right. So recommendations to wrap up the week. Anything?
Devil Wears Prada 2. We watched it in theaters. It was pretty good.
Yeah, I've heard that it is quite good for a 20-year in the making sequel. Pretty good. The first movie was good.
First movie was great. Yeah,
Yeah,
we watched it
fun
to
movie.
prepare.
Yeah.
I would recommend watching the first one before you go see the second one
Is
for obvious reasons,
is there
but
enough like sort of continuation of the actual story that it makes sense to
yeah,
know the first one?
I think so. There's a lot of history between those characters from the first movie that you might miss out on if you haven't seen it. So I'd recommend watching both. But yeah, worth watching.
Anything else?
No, not really. I think
No?
that's pretty much, yeah.
I picked up another book. It's called The Frequency Era, and it's by a guy named Chris Walker. And I've followed Chris Walker for a long time now. And it's a good book. It's essentially kind of, I'm only about a third of the way through it, but I'm thinking it kind of is going to end up feeling very similar to what the Simon Willison article. Like his thesis is that, you know, as we've gone through the agricultural, you know, I'm going to call it the era, right? Let's call it the age, right? The agricultural age, the industrial age, the knowledge age. Yeah. As we've gone through those, essentially, there's always something that is scarce, and that's what people pay for, right? And then that thing becomes less scarce, and therefore the value that society assigns to that drops and people make less money. So he kind of has this thesis as it's going through each of those different ages. And he thinks we're going into the next age where, you know, when you think about information, sort of the time that we've all grown up in and worked in, the thing that was scarce is like, I would call it just knowledge, right? It was hard. It wasn't as hard to obtain as it used to be. There's lots of knowledge sources, but people that were really good at knowing this stuff, they were scarce. Therefore, they were paid quite well. But now, when you look at it, right, there is no scarcity of knowledge anymore. There is no scarcity of code anymore. So, sort of the value that gets assigned to that is decreasing rapidly than any of the ages that we've gone through before. So what comes out of it? And I haven't got to the what comes out of it yet, but it's a really interesting book on kind of sort of seeing the same cycle happening over and over again. And as they transition between these ages, the transition period, the number of years that it takes gets shorter and shorter. And because it's shorter and shorter, more people end up getting kind of caught up in it and having a really hard time. So, interesting book. I have a theory on kind of where it might go, and I think it relates back to. I'm going to give you my theory, and you tell me if you think you're on the same page. I think it's kind of related back to the Simon Willison thing that we just talked about, in the sense that, you know, an agent will, or let me just say AI, will know more than any human could ever possibly know, right? And it's able to generate information, code, whatever you want to call it, in just much, much faster for far less dollars, right? So you have to think about the things that it can't do, at least right now. The things I think that it can't do are kind of some of the topics I think we discussed when we were talking about Simon Willison, this idea of design and understanding best practices, like things that are still inherently coming from a human mind, creativity and stuff like that. I'm thinking that that's what he's going to say is scarce. I'll be interested to see if I'm right or not. What do you think?
I was kind of thinking it goes back to like the attention economy. Like, are you creating, or are you a source of useful, good signal or interesting signal, at least, like, is what you're doing interesting?
But your theory is good, as I think about it, because that's the title of the book, Frequency, right? So like, are you doing interesting things on a frequent enough basis for other people to notice? I don't know. Maybe. Who knows?
Or are you like tuned into what's important? Maybe.
Maybe.
Because like there's a lot of noise on the internet now too, right? Yeah. Like lot of they call it brain rot content, right? So
yeah, man.
That tells you everything you need to know.
But. Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm gonna keep reading. So maybe by next week I can give you the actual outcome. We're either of us right or just completely out there. Maybe it's gonna go in a completely different direction.
Okay. Maybe I'll pick it up and we can do a book club or something.
There we go. Just like grade 12 again. Everybody, you got your book report ready for next Wednesday, man. All right. Well, I guess that's the show.
All right.
Yeah, and as I was saying, there's the show. I didn't change the outro music, and I don't want to go back to
Uh-oh.
boring outro music. So we're just going to play the intro again as we wrap up the episode. We'll see everybody next
The
week.
outro.
The outro
Yep,
be or the
see ya.
intro becomes the
Outro is the
outro.
intro, the which is the outro, which is the intro.
Very
Yeah.
meta.
Super.
There we go.
So I built this MCP.